Tracy, it's a treat to have you here today with us, and we're very much looking forward to hearing you speak. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Tracy Boardman.
Thanks so much, Mike. Wow, I should read my Amazon reviews more often. That is pithy, I think, is the word. Well, it's such a huge pleasure to be here in beautiful Stratford, and thank you, Becky, for inviting me. It seems a long time ago now, but it's come around very quickly. And, of course, it's the big day, isn't it, today? The anniversary of Anne Boleyn's execution. Obviously, and therefore very fitting to be talking about her daughter, Elizabeth. But when Harry and Meghan announced the date, we already had this in the diary, didn't we, Becky? So that was all sorted. But when they announced the date, I was pretty taken aback. I thought, you know, it's not the most auspicious date for a royal wedding. So, and I was talking to my dad about it. I said, I can't believe they've chosen the 19th of May. He said, I know, it's the FA Cup final. Don't get my love of history from my dad, clearly. Anyway, yes, I'm here to talk about Elizabeth. She's my all-time historical heroine, the one that I always keep coming back to, actually. She was a study for my PhD and just an everlasting inspiration, really. But she's traditionally been defined by the men in her life. You know, just that very title, the Virgin Queen, has sparked lots of debate about the nature of her relationships with the men who surrounded her. Also, her more sober relationships with the likes of Burleigh and Walsingham have been endlessly studied and debated. And Elizabeth herself fostered the impression that she was very much a man's woman. She famously declared she had the heart and stomach of a king. She would refer to herself as a prince. And she was pretty damning of the female sex in general. She once was complimented by a visiting ambassador on her ability to speak many languages. And she retorted, "It is no marvel to teach a woman to talk. It is harder to teach her to hold her tongue." But all of this was just a front. And when you actually go beneath the surface, you realise Elizabeth was pretending to regret that she was a weak and feeble woman in order to fit in a very male-dominated society, and I have to say, to manipulate the male courtiers and counsellors around her. And she did it brilliantly. It really won them over, and she came to just dominate them, and they absolutely adored Queen Elizabeth. But when you unpick the layers of her other relationships, you realise that actually the women in her life were just as significant, if not more so, than the men. Now, I used to say when introducing this book, the women were far more important than the men. But my next book after Henry is Elizabeth's Men. So I'm kind of thinking I ought to just qualify that a little bit. But certainly the women were enormously important. And I want to talk to you about the ones that I think shed an interesting, surprising, often not very complimentary, I have to say, light upon this most famous of queens. Now, there are more than 30 women whose stories I cover in the book. I'm not going to cover all 30 this morning. Really, it's just edited highlights and hopefully then a jumping off point for you to ask questions at the end. Well, the first woman, of course, was the one whose anniversary is marked today. Anne Boleyn, known throughout Europe as the great whore, the concubine. She was despised because Henry VIII had set aside his beloved first wife, Catherine of Aragon, in order to marry Anne. And what Anne had promised Henry, amongst many other things, was that if he gave her the crown, if he married her, which he did in 1533, then she would give him a son. And that's what Henry needed more than anything else in the year 1533, because he'd had more than 20 years of bitter disappointments in that respect. His marriage to Catherine had produced only one living daughter, and he needed a son. So eventually, and not in any small part due to my man Thomas Cromwell, he was able to sever England from Rome, appoint himself head of the church, and get his annulment. It wasn't a divorce, it was annulment. He claimed the marriage was never valid in the first place. And he marries Anne in secret in January 1533, by which time she was already pregnant. And in August 1533, she went to Greenwich for her confinement. This was a month-long period when a royal wife really goes into seclusion, complete seclusion, served only by women. It was crucial. There was a whole set of regulations for the successful delivery of an heir. And so on the morning, early hours in the morning of the 7th of September, when Anne reached the end of her labour, it resulted not in the birth of a boy, as she'd promised, but of course in the birth of Princess Elizabeth. Well, Anne had been so confident in her promise to Henry that she'd already had letters drafted to the leaders of Europe announcing the birth of a prince. And you can see where they've gone back and added two S's at the end of the word. It didn't go down terribly well, I think it's fair to say, with Henry VIII. He was bitterly disappointed. But it wasn't the end for Anne Boleyn, because she'd at least proved she could have a healthy child. Well, as for her infant daughter, you might think that Anne had every reason to resent Elizabeth. She was, if nothing else, a deep embarrassment. All of Anne's enemies were delighted that she'd failed by having only a useless girl. What possible good could come of Elizabeth? I kind of wish Henry had known it would turn out quite well. But in fact, Anne doted on her young daughter. She had a special velvet cushion made so that the tiny infant could be set next to her when she was on her throne conducting her queenly duties. This was very unusual. But Anne loved Elizabeth. She liked to have her close. But there was nothing she could do to stop tradition. And when Elizabeth was just 3 months old, as always happened with royal offspring, she was packed off to her own household, Hatfield, with a veritable army of servants and attendants to cater for every need of this three-month-old princess. And the list of attendants is truly staggering. They included four ladies called rockers, whose job was to rock the cradle when Elizabeth became fretful. Not bad work if you can get it. But two of the ladies who soon joined the household at Hatfield would become hugely influential in Elizabeth's future life. And indeed, they would serve her all the way up until she was queen and beyond. Apologies for the quality of the image on the left. It's about the best one that survives, of Blanche Parry, Elizabeth's nurse. And really, I think, of all Elizabeth's women, Blanche was the favourite. And for good reason. She served Elizabeth with greater loyalty than any other woman. She gave up everything for this young girl. And she turned her back on her own personal happiness. She didn't marry, she didn't have children of her own. She dedicated herself to Elizabeth from the time of the young princess's birth. And really, that was telling, because it raised the marker for other women, and none of them managed to meet it. But that's what Elizabeth expected. She expected the same dedication to duty as Blanche had shown. Equally devoted was Kat Astley, shown on the right, or Catherine Champernoun, as she was when she joined Elizabeth's household. And she was Elizabeth's governess, and again, would be a very major influence in her future life. Well, another regular at Hatfield was Elizabeth's elder half-sister, Mary, who was 17 years older than Elizabeth, so a very big sister. And she, against the odds, seems to have rather doted on Elizabeth herself. And I say against the odds. Of course, Mary is the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. Elizabeth is the daughter of Anne Boleyn. You don't think the two sisters are going to get on very well. But Mary really does seem to adore her little sister. She's naturally a very kind, a very maternal woman, doesn't necessarily deserve just going down in history as Bloody Mary, which is how we tend to know her. And events that happened on this very day in 1536 inspired Mary to dote on Elizabeth even more, because, of course, as I mentioned, it was on that day, the 19th of May, 1536, that Elizabeth's mother, Anne Boleyn, was executed at the Tower. And her crime was adultery with not just one, but five men. And much as I love Cromwell, I think he can really be blamed for Anne's death. She was almost certainly innocent of the charges against her. And in fact, her real crime was not giving Henry a son. Elizabeth's birth had been her only living child, in fact. There were a series of miscarriages that followed, and the last one had occurred in January 1536. Anne had been 14 weeks pregnant, and they could tell that the miscarried child was male. This was a final straw for Henry, and he privately instructed Cromwell to get him out of the marriage. And Cromwell was by then an enemy of Anne, so he got rid of her rather more permanently than I think Henry expected. While Elizabeth was quick to notice the change in her status, how happit yesterday Lady Princess and today but Lady Elizabeth, she asked the head of her household. Now, she's only 2 years and 8 months old. She's quite a precocious young girl, very highly educated. She knows that there's been a change in her status. And there's another change too, because Anne Boleyn, even though she lived apart from Elizabeth, had never stopped sending her daughter presents. She'd sent her many beautiful clothes, made-to-measure gowns, tiny little velvet caps for the young princess. Of course, they all now stopped. And before long, Lady Margaret Bryan, who was Elizabeth's governess at the time, was obliged to write to Thomas Cromwell and beg for new clothes for Elizabeth, because she was all but forgotten in Hatfield. Henry didn't want to hear about her because she reminded him of her mother, Anne Boleyn. So poor old Elizabeth's status really had nosedived as a result of Anne's execution. And we don't know how much she was told, if anything, of her mother's death, whether her staff tried to paint Anne in a very sort of black light, really, a dark light. We don't know. But what we do know is that Elizabeth grew up to be quite fascinated by her late mother. So if they tried to turn Elizabeth against Anne, it certainly didn't work. She really revered her mother's memory. And a sign of this came with something approaching teenage rebellion, I think we can call it, because when Elizabeth was about 13 years old, a portrait was painted, not only this famous one, which she gave to her brother Edward, who was then king, Edward VI, but just before that, a painting was taken shortly before Henry VIII's death, which celebrated the Tudor dynasty. So Henry commissioned this, and it certainly wasn't painted from life, because his wife, shown just as we're looking to Henry's right, is Jane Seymour. Now, she'd been dead for some time by the time this was painted, because she was represented here as being the only successful one of the six wives. She gave Henry the son, Edward, who's shown on the left. Now, there you go, if you can see there, that's the elder Princess Mary. This is Princess Elizabeth. Now, you'd have to have very, very keen eyesight to see why I'm showing you this painting, because Elizabeth chose this as a way of expressing her loyalty to her late mother. She was having to take part in this charade and pretend that Anne had never existed and it's all about Jane Seymour. But if you peer very closely, and I have got a close-up, this is Elizabeth in the painting, and what she's wearing around her neck is her mother's famous A pendant. And I think it's a very, very telling symbol of how Elizabeth felt about Anne Boleyn. She revered her memory for the rest of her life, and one of her other favourite possessions was this locket ring, which interestingly now is at Chequers. It opens to reveal two portraits. On the bottom is Elizabeth herself, she's queen by that time, And at the top is her mother, Anne Boleyn. And this was one of Elizabeth's most cherished possessions. She kept this ring with her to the day she died. So those who say that Anne Boleyn had no influence on Elizabeth are just wrong. She really did give her daughter something to look up to. And I think Elizabeth, as she found out more of Anne's history, really came to admire Anne's tenacity and indeed her courage. Even Anne's enemies had been forced to admit she was braver than a lion. Well, of course, after Anne's demise, there were one or two stepmothers for Elizabeth. The first of those, Jane Seymour, who I've already mentioned. She doesn't have much of a relationship with Elizabeth. And in fact, the main impact of Jane Seymour on Elizabeth is a negative one because she gives birth to the son, which places Elizabeth even further from the throne. Rather more positively, and the woman who's long been my favourite of the six wives, Anne of Cleves. Now, Anne was, I think, she's gone down in history as the ugly wife, of course, the one Henry couldn't stand the sight of, so quickly had the marriage dissolved. I think she's the most successful of Henry's wives. She'd seen what happened to wives who stood out against Henry. So the minute he suggested an annulment, absolutely no problem. She was very, very happy to sign on the dotted line. And for that, she was given £30,000 a year and five palaces. I think good on Anne of Cleves. She deserves a bit of a rehabilitation in history. And also, of all the wives that followed her own mother, Elizabeth was closest to Anne of Cleves. And that's little known. She was close to another stepmother, but it was Anne who had, I think, the most formative impact on Elizabeth. She stayed with Anne of Cleves very often at Hever Castle, which was one of those five palaces, and of course was Elizabeth's mother's childhood home as well. And I think from Anne of Cleves, Elizabeth learned the skill or the art of pragmatism. And this would really define her as queen. You don't necessarily hold out for principles. Pragmatism gets you much further, and Anne of Cleves had taught her that. She's followed in quick succession Catherine Howard. Apart from gifting Elizabeth some jewels, there isn't much of a relationship there. But what does have an impact on Elizabeth is hearing that Catherine Howard has been executed just as her own mother had been. Now, Elizabeth by then is eight, and she's much more aware of what's going on. And it's said that she says that at that very moment when she hears of Catherine Howard's execution, she remarks to her childhood friend, Robert Dudley, who will become Earl of Leicester in later life, one of her great favourites. She remarks to Robert Dudley upon hearing of the execution, "I will never marry." So you can see that her childhood experiences, particularly involving women, are starting to shape Elizabeth's outlook. Well, I mentioned she was close to another stepmother, and of course that was Catherine Parr. Elizabeth absolutely adored Catherine. Catherine shaped her beliefs, I think, more than any other woman, certainly in terms of her religious stance. She was a great reformist. Was Catherine seen as a radical by the conservatives at court? And after Henry's death, Catherine married the man she'd wanted to marry all along. Henry was her third husband, but she'd been in love for a long time with Thomas Seymour, a brother of Jane Seymour. And this scandalised the kingdom. She'd married so quickly after Henry's death. And Mary, her other stepdaughter, would have nothing to do with her. But Elizabeth forgave her at once and went to live with Catherine and her husband in Chelsea in their beautiful manor. Now, this is Thomas Seymour. And although Catherine Parr's influence on Elizabeth had been nothing but positive up till now, their association would lead to disaster once Elizabeth was living with Catherine and her new husband at Chelsea. Because Thomas Seymour was a bit of a rake, I think it's fair to say, very ambitious as well. And he took something of a shine to the teenage Elizabeth. And his behaviour was bordering on inappropriate, I think we can say. There are famous accounts of him bursting into Elizabeth's bedchamber early in the morning and tickling her in bed. On another occasion, he actually got his wife, Catherine, to hold Elizabeth down while he cut Elizabeth's dress into 100 pieces. It was all seen as harmless horseplay by Thomas, and he persuaded his wife that it was too. But something happened. Catherine caught Thomas and Elizabeth in some sort of uncompromising position. The sources aren't clear exactly what it was, but it was enough to make Catherine ask Elizabeth to leave. And it created a scandal, as you might imagine. And there have been rumours that Elizabeth, who went away to a house in the country and was reported ill for a few months, and then there was a visit by a midwife, so it said, there are rumours about exactly what happened to Elizabeth during those months after she left Chelsea. I personally don't believe any of them. I think she was just waiting for the dust to settle before she re-emerged into public life. Well, not long afterwards, once she'd come back, she had a complete image change. Gone were the ostentatious dresses that Elizabeth loved so much. She was now wearing black and white. She had her hair covered in a very modest hood. Clearly, she knows she's got a job to do in salvaging her reputation. And then 1553, another of Elizabeth's women comes to influence her life in a very profound way. It is, of course, her sister, Mary. I mentioned she's known as Bloody Mary because of her persecution of Protestants. She wants to return England to the Roman Catholic fold. And it's religion that causes the relationship between Mary and her sister Elizabeth to deteriorate very rapidly after Mary comes to the throne. Because Mary knows that Elizabeth is more popular than she is. She knows too that she's a figurehead for all those who are rebelling against Mary's regime, including Thomas Wyatt in 1554, who names Elizabeth as one of his conspirators. And Elizabeth is thrown into the Tower of London as a result and put under intense questioning. But she's so clever that she talks her way out of trouble. And it's said that her sister Mary had literally been hovering over her death warrant with her quill poised, and then decides there really is no evidence to convict her sister. So she is released from the Tower on the 19th of May, 1554, the very same day, the anniversary of her mother's execution. She survives her sister's reign, and she becomes queen herself in November 1558. And I think what Mary has really provided for Elizabeth during her short reign is an example of what not to do. Okay, top of the list, don't force the issue of religion. Elizabeth famously declares she's not going to make windows into men's souls. She is a Protestant, but she's not going to enforce it rigorously. Second, don't marry a foreigner. English people don't like this. They're very xenophobic in the 16th century. They don't want a Spaniard as king. So Elizabeth thinks, okay, I can't marry a foreigner. It's going to be a bit divisive to marry an Englishman. I'll be the Virgin Queen. I'm simplifying it, of course, but her sister did have a profound influence. I think as well, Mary had given Elizabeth a real fear of the whole childbirth side of being a royal wife, because Mary had suffered the humiliation of two phantom pregnancies, they're known as. Now, it's very possible, because Mary did have the symptoms of pregnancy both time with a very swollen stomach, it's possible she was suffering from a form of cancer that actually killed her in the end in November 1558. Now, Elizabeth had been in attendance on her sister during her confinements, awaiting the birth that never came. And I think just that and the history of the other women in her life to date had not convinced Elizabeth that marriage and childbirth were a particularly good idea. So she's queen, and there is widespread rejoicing amongst her people that this flame-haired, beautiful Tudor princess, who is much more moderate than her sister, who isn't married to a Spaniard, is going to bring them into a golden age. But as is always the case, that initial wave of popularity doesn't last very long, does it? And there are soon rival claimants to the throne. And actually, in Elizabeth's case, all of the most dangerous rivals to her were women. Now, one of the earliest and the most dangerous was this lady, Lady Catherine Grey, sister of the more famous Lady Jane Grey, who, of course, was the 9 days queen, very briefly queen after Elizabeth's brother Edward VI died. Well, they were of royal blood, the Grey sisters, and Catherine Grey was a Catholic, and that was very dangerous for Elizabeth because, of course, that brought the might of Catholic Europe in support of Catherine Grey. And as you can see, she'd also proved that she was fertile. She had two sons. Interestingly, this son shown here, her eldest son, was born inside the Tower of London. Why on earth did Catherine choose to give birth in the Tower? She didn't choose it. Elizabeth had thrown her there because she discovered that Catherine was plotting against her, that she'd married Edward Seymour, another blood claimant, without Elizabeth's consent, so she'd had them both thrown into the Tower. By the time Catherine arrived at that dreaded fortress, she was already 8 months pregnant. She gave birth there, she was allowed to keep her son there with her, but the guards were given orders from Elizabeth to keep the Catherine and her husband, who was also in the Tower, strictly separate. Clearly, they took pity on the couple, because about a year later, another child was born inside the Tower, another son. And by now, it was such a cozy arrangement that we have a record that two of the yeoman warders stood as godparents to the new child. Now, Elizabeth heard all of this. Can you imagine her reaction? She already despises Catherine Grey. She's furious with her first transgression. She was said to have gone the colour of a corpse upon being told of Catherine's latest outrage. This time, she had Catherine removed from the Tower and kept in strict segregation at a house in Suffolk, well away from her husband and her sons. She never saw them again. Poor old Catherine pined away and eventually starved herself to death at the age of just 28. And I think Catherine Grey's tragic story shows us the more vicious and unforgiving side of Elizabeth. And I'm afraid Catherine's sister, Mary Grey, didn't fare an awful lot better because the Grey sisters don't learn from example. And Mary married in secret without Elizabeth's permission. Now, Mary was a very different kettle of fish to her sister, who was a great beauty, and Elizabeth was jealous of Catherine. Poor old Mary was about 4'2". She was known as being the smallest lady in court. And she married the tallest man in the court, who was 6'9", a veritable giant of a man called Sir Thomas Keyes. So, you know, she didn't choose a sort of low-profile candidate, really. So the marriage was soon discovered, and the inevitable happened. Both of them were thrown in prison. Elizabeth had learned from the mistake of Catherine. She put them in separate prisons. They would never see each other again. And this is a story that's repeated with many of Elizabeth's other ladies. And I would just hark back to my reference to Blanche Parry, the woman who gave up everything, marriage included, for her service to Elizabeth. This is what Elizabeth expects. She hates it when the women of her court marry, full stop, but she particularly hates it when they don't seek her permission first. Well, of course, her most dangerous rival was this woman, Mary, Queen of Scots. She has all of the credentials that make a rival of Elizabeth. She's Catholic, very, very strong claim to the English throne. She too has proved that she is fertile. She marries as her second husband, Henry, Lord Darnley, and has a son, which makes her even more dangerous because now the whispers against Elizabeth are getting louder. Her council are just confounded at the fact that she's refusing to take a husband. They don't understand it. Why wouldn't a queen wish to marry and have a man govern for her as her sister Mary had done? Well, by contrast, Mary, Queen of Scots, is doing everything by the book. The two queens couldn't be more different. You could write an entire book about their relationship. Mary, in short, rules by the heart, Elizabeth by the head. And I think you realise why when you contrast their upbringings. Elizabeth has had a turbulent one, I think it's fair to say. Mother executed, another stepmother executed. You know, just the turbulent history she's undergone with her sister Mary. Mary, Queen of Scots, has been raised a pampered princess. Spent much of her childhood in France, goes back to Scotland, marries. Everything seems to be coming easily to her. But it soon becomes obvious that it's not going to be as easy for Mary in Scotland as it had been in France. And she's a disaster as queen. She thinks that she can carry on just following her heart in the way she always has. So when her husband, Henry Lord Darnley, who turns out to be a pretty nasty piece of work, is found murdered, strangled after an explosion in Edinburgh, Mary marries or elopes with the chief suspect, Bothwell, the Earl of Bothwell. Well, of course, her subjects in Scotland rebel against her. There's a coup to oust her from power. And Mary, who's never met her rival, her cousin Elizabeth, decides to take Elizabeth's lovely letters at their word. And she flees south to England and throws herself on Elizabeth's mercy. Big mistake. Should have gone to France. Would have turned out much better. Instead, she goes to Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, of course, makes all the right noises. She says, you know, I'm so sorry this has happened. Of course, I will assist you. Of course, I will imprison you. And that's exactly what she does. She makes it very clear very early on that Mary is not an honoured guest. She is a captive. And in a sort of way, Mary is even more dangerous to Elizabeth on English soil than she had been in Scotland. Because even though Elizabeth is her custodian, you might imagine how Elizabeth's Catholic subjects see Mary now as being tantalisingly close. And there are many plots and rebellions that begin to spring up to put Mary on the throne. Most famously, the Babington Conspiracy of 1586, by which time Mary has been a prisoner here for almost 20 years. Well, this results ultimately in Mary's execution. Elizabeth has been under intense pressure from her council for many years to put Mary to death, and the Babington Conspiracy eventually persuades her that there's nothing else for it. She signs Mary's death warrant and immediately denies all knowledge and blames her entire council and puts most of them in the Tower. But everybody knows it was because of Elizabeth that Mary is executed in 1587. And it's as a direct result of that that Philip II launches his famous Armada the following year in 1558 to avenge the Queen of Scots. Well, of course, it gives Elizabeth her finest hour. And so you might say that she's won that battle of the queens between her and Mary. It looks like Mary's having the last laugh in sparking this great invasion force. But Elizabeth is triumphant in no small part thanks to the good old English weather, which blows the Spanish fleet off course. And so now we enter the later years of Elizabeth's reign. And really, it's a very different story in terms of her relationships with women. And they become more contrasted. On the one hand, you have her faithful servants, the women such as Blanche and Cat Astley, who've served her for many years. On the other, you have the younger generation who start to flirt with Elizabeth's favourites, such as Robert Dudley, I mentioned, Earl of Leicester, who has been Elizabeth's closest confidant for many, many years. You can see them here dancing at court. Well, this woman commits the cardinal sin of marrying in secret. It's a bit of a theme, but the man she marries is Robert Dudley. It doesn't get any worse than that. Well, Elizabeth doesn't manage to have her thrown into the Tower, but the next time that Lettice arrives at court, it's well recorded that Elizabeth summons her up to the throne and then boxes her ears, and she's never seen at court again. You've got to admire Elizabeth for her direct approach sometime. Another favourite, Walter Raleigh, gets another lady into hot water. In fact, more than hot water, he gets Bess Throckmorton pregnant and marries her. This time, Elizabeth has her prey. She puts them both in the tower, although tellingly releases Raleigh well before she releases Bess. She forgives women more slowly. Here we have Elizabeth Vernon, who falls pregnant by the Earl of Southampton. It all goes horribly wrong again. And so the pattern is repeated. Elizabeth sets very high moral standards in her court, and her ladies always fail to meet them. Well, Elizabeth, as she grows older, realizes that she's no longer the most desirable woman at court. And this is when you see the effort that goes into creating her public image just intensify. So she appears at court wearing ever more magnificent dresses. This is one of my favorite. And by contrast, introduces an edict that her ladies must wear only black or white. So her own dresses are shown off to best effect. Her ladies also become instrumental in creating the so-called mask of youth that ensures that Elizabeth never ages, lucky woman. So it takes her ladies about 2 hours every morning to apply that thick white lead makeup to her face and neck and hands. By the way, lead isn't great as a beauty product. So if you put that on your skin on a regular basis, it withers the skin. It actually accelerated the aging process for Elizabeth, ironically enough. And so she just orders them to put more and more of it on. And there are many other tricks of the trade that her ladies have to use, including wigs, including false teeth made out of wood, including plumpers, clots of material to plump out her cheeks, and so they appear more youthful. And so that when Elizabeth appears in public before visiting ambassadors, they all write home of her youth and her beauty. And one from this assembly shown here reported back to his foreign master, "The Queen of England can be no more than 20 years old." This was written when she was in her late 50s, so she would have been delighted with that report. Well, the lady shown in the middle here, dressed in black, is almost certainly Blanche Parry. And this is a monument to Blanche in her home church of Bacton in rural Herefordshire. And it shows that Blanche, who died in the early 1590s, when she was approaching 90 years old herself, she'd served Elizabeth all her life. And it just shows how she still revered her. This is how she wanted to be remembered, kneeling before her sovereign. Well, there were more positive relationships as well in Elizabeth's later years. Lady Mary Sidney was another long-serving lady in Elizabeth's court. And so dedicated was she to Elizabeth's service that when Elizabeth contracted smallpox, Lady Mary was the only lady who was willing to attend her, and I'm afraid she contracted the disease herself. And unlike with Elizabeth, it left Lady Mary so hideously disfigured that she was obliged to wear a mask at court ever after. Another favourite was Lady Anne Russell, Countess of Warwick, who was said to be more beloved and in greater favour with Elizabeth than any other lady in the kingdom. Also Catherine Howard, and you find that, by the way, many of these beloved ladies are of a similar generation to Elizabeth, perhaps only a little bit younger than she was herself. The reason Catherine Howard was favoured is that she was a Boleyn relative, and you find this with Elizabeth, that it's another way of expressing her devotion to her late mother. She surrounds herself with the Boleyns, the Careys, other relations from her mother's side of the family. And I want to just point out this lady as well, because she's not all that well known, and her story fascinated me. She has the wonderful name of Helena Snackenborg. She's a Swedish lady-in-waiting. She arrives in England accompanying her mistress, the Princess of Sweden, in the mid-1560s, and Elizabeth takes such a shine to her that she decides she's going to keep her as her own lady-in-waiting. And Helena is only too glad to, because she has come to rather hero worship Elizabeth. And reading one of Helena's letters in the National Archives was a complete joy, because I saw that Helena was so keen to mimic and to imitate her sovereign that her signature under the H has the same flourish that Elizabeth uses under hers. I love details like that. Now, the other reason I'm showing you Helena's picture is a shameless plug. Mike mentioned in his introduction that my new novel is out today, and actually it's about Helena's daughter. She is the heroine of my new novel. And by the way, just even more of a shameless plug, it's out in hardback today, here, for the very first time. You've got it before anybody else. It's not out until the 18th of June, and it's not out in paperback till next year. So there you go. Anyway, enough of the plugs, and I'm back to Elizabeth, who is served by these faithful women until the very end. This is a famous painting of Elizabeth with time and death in waiting. And she lives to almost 70 years old. She dies in her 70th year in March 1603 at Richmond Palace. And at the very end, she's chosen just to be attended by women. She's been defined by men throughout her life, but it's her closest female attendants who are with Elizabeth when she breathes her last on the 24th of May. And it's said that on the last day of her life, she has a nightmare. She's drifting in and out of sleep, and she has a dream about her old rival, Mary, Queen of Scots, and is said to have uttered her name almost as the last words that she said. So it seems she's plagued with some guilt for Mary's execution. And in fact, I mentioned Mary didn't have the last laugh with the Armada, but she did with Elizabeth's successor, who is Mary's son. James VI of Scotland becomes James I of a united kingdom. Well, Elizabeth's body lays in state for a full month, and then there is a funeral at Westminster Abbey. And here you can see a detail from a sketch of the funeral procession showing all of the ladies who had so revered Elizabeth in life, and they are following behind her coffin as it makes its final journey. And it's these women and all of those others I've mentioned and more who have really defined Elizabeth. She is so often, as I mentioned, seen in the context of the men in her life. But I am going to argue it's the women who really shaped the Virgin Queen. Thank you very much.
Right, question time, ladies and gentlemen. Do we have any questions, please?